From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at how changes to absentee voting will affect voters in Milwaukee. We'll learn how Milwaukee compares to other cities in racial equity of home ownership.
There are other cities that have a similar profile that are less inequitable than Milwaukee is. So, in other words, it doesn't have to be this way.
We'll speak with the Behavioral Health Division on what services they offer and the challenges they're trying to meet.
We will serve anybody, no matter how challenging their situation, without any sort of issue around their ability to pay. And I just don't think people are aware that help is just a phone call away through our crisis service.
Plus, learn about some of the many community events happening this month in Milwaukee. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. If you've struggled with mental health over the last couple of years, you're not alone. Later in the show, we'll look at some of the challenges facing people who try to access help, and some solutions. But first, next Tuesday is the partisan primary election in Wisconsin, and many Wisconsinites have already voted. Since 2020, absentee voting has become increasingly popular among Wisconsinites. But there have been a number of changes to the process due to decisions by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Claire Woodall-Vogue is the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission, and she joins me to talk about how these changes could impact you. Claire, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I think a lot of people are going to know that there have been changes to absentee voting. We're right ahead of the primary here. What are some of the biggest changes to absentee voting that people need to be aware of?
Yeah, the biggest change is that we have a state Supreme Court ruling that we cannot use those absentee by mail drop boxes that many voters became accustomed to in 2020 during the height of the pandemic. So if you're going to vote absentee by mail, you want to make sure you're giving yourself enough time to either mail it back or that you can fit us into your schedule to return it to an in-person absentee voting location, also known as early voting, or to return it to our office on election day.
Okay, that gets to, I think, a big question for people. It's Wednesday today. If you haven't mailed your ballot yet, can you still put it in a mailbox, or do you really need to be going to, as you said, either your offices or one of the early voting locations?
So if you're listening today and you still have your absentee ballot, do not mail it. USPS is saying to give anything at least 7 days. And if you were to mail it today, we can't guarantee that we'd receive it by next Tuesday. Instead, we have 4 early voting locations. There's one at Midtown Center, one at Good Hope Library, the Zeidler Municipal Building, or Zablocki Library. And we have staff outside who will do a curbside pickup for you. You don't even have to get out of your car, and you can turn it in directly to us. That is through Saturday, or on next Monday or Tuesday, we have curbside pickup right here at City Hall on the corner of Market Street and Kilbourne.
Okay, but to clarify, if you have an absentee ballot, you can't bring it to your basic polling place unless it happens to also be one of the early voting places.
That's correct. So in the city of Milwaukee, we process all absentee ballots at a place called Central Count. We have one central location on election day where we process ballots. And what that means is you can't bring your absentee ballot to your polling place on election day. If you haven't returned it, you can always still go and vote on election day. But if you are holding on to your ballot on next Monday or Tuesday, you will need to return it either to City Hall or to the Central Count location, which is in your absentee letter that you get.
Now, there's a key word you're using there, you. There has been some questions about whether or not you can have a loved one or anyone else
put your absentee ballot in the mail, deliver it in any way? Do you have to be the person who is handing it to election workers?
Yes. So, and except for in very special circumstances, the state Supreme Court also ruled that you must personally deliver your own absentee ballot. Husband can't take a husband and wife's ballot and drop it off to us. The husband and the wife, everyone in the household who has a ballot has to personally return it if they're not mailing it. Now, the exception is if you have a disability and you need assistance. It's the city of Milwaukee's belief that you are still protected under federal law. So we will record who your agent is and we will collect your phone number just to be on the safe side. But you do have a right to assistance, and that includes delivering your absentee ballot if you need so due to a disability.
And that's through the ADA, is that right?
Yes.
Now, you personally have faced a lot of public harassment as a result of your work. What are the kinds of things that you're running into right now as an election worker?
You know, I think the thing that election workers are running into the most right now is just anxiety about what could happen. I personally have received a lot of threats, a lot of emails and voicemails over the past 2 years, but luckily, our election workers here in Milwaukee have not had any instances where they personally have received any threats, but it's more of this ongoing rhetoric that the 2020 election was stolen and this distrust of the election process, where our election workers just kind of live with this anxiety of what could happen. So I've been spending the summer training our chief inspectors on de-escalation techniques, general safety things to be aware of in the polling place. But really, it's just a sense of the unknown because we can see how rocky democracy is right now, especially with this ongoing rhetoric, even from, you know, candidates and elected officials.
With this kind of vitriolic rhetoric, are you having difficulty recruiting people to become election workers?
You know, we'll never know the people who aren't applying or aren't returning necessarily because of that fear, but we always struggle to recruit election workers. It's an ongoing struggle in a city our size where we need about 1,800 workers. So if you're listening, you know, feel free to go out and apply. Anyone in Milwaukee County can work for the City of Milwaukee Election Commission at a polling place. You would just go to milwaukee.gov/election. And click on the election worker tab. But we are well staffed for August. It's just an ongoing issue that everyone's facing right now with workforce issues and making sure that people show up. But it is certainly a fear of some election officials and election workers who I've spoken to. But so far, most people who are working for us are doing so out of a sense of a civic duty, and it hasn't prevented them from working.
All right. Well, Claire, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and good luck with the election.
Thank you so much.
Claire Woodall-Vogue is the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission. If you're planning to vote in the primary, you're going to need identification, even if you're already registered. In the state of Wisconsin, a variety of photo IDs are accepted, including a U.S. passport, DOT-issued photo ID card, and a Wisconsin driver license, among many others. And if you're like I was a few years back, you may need to get a new photo ID to vote. Here's how I navigated that process. This is the sound of my normal morning commute, but today isn't a normal day for me. Today, I'm getting my first Wisconsin ID. Although I'm originally from Wisconsin, I don't drive, so I've never had a license. While I've had other forms of IDs over the years, I didn't have the necessary ID this year to vote in the state of Wisconsin. So I boarded my usual bus with an unusual destination for me, Milwaukee's downtown division of motor vehicles.
Now serving C-209 at counter,
All of the DMVs in the Milwaukee area open after 8 o'clock in the morning and close before 5 o'clock. The majority of them are only open on weekdays, but there are some exceptions.
We have two locations in Milwaukee, Milwaukee Southwest, which is actually Greendale, Milwaukee Northwest, Madison East, and then we have Appleton, Wausau, Eau Claire, and La Crosse. They all offer Saturday morning hours on a weekly basis.
That's Christina Boardman. She's the administrator of the Wisconsin DMV. Boardman explains that if I were in my hometown, Lake Geneva, the nearest DMV in Elkhorn wouldn't be open on the weekend. For a lot of working people in my hometown, that could mean either taking off work or driving nearly 2 hours round trip to the nearest DMV with weekend hours. If you're like me and you're getting your first Wisconsin ID, you'll want a few things, including proof of your name, date of birth, address in Wisconsin, legal presence in the U.S., and your Social Security number. Reed Magny, the public information officer at the Wisconsin Election Commission, says getting these documents can take a lot of work.
For a lot of people, there's some work on the back end that they've got to do, or shall we say preparatory work, to get all your documents together.
For me, that meant taking the train to Chicago to get a copy of my birth certificate. Each state has different policies regarding these certificates. In Illinois, I had to pay $10 for a certified copy, and I needed a valid government-issued ID. To get my Social Security card, I needed documents that proved my citizenship, age, and identity, like a driver's license, a passport, or a state ID card. So, in order to get the documentation I needed to get a state ID card, it seemed like I already needed to have that ID card. But I'll admit, this part of the process was a bit easier for me, because when I got all of these documents, I still had a valid passport. I wondered, what would have happened if I'd waited until my passport expired? What would have happened if I didn't have these vital documents? Reed Magny advises to bring whatever you do have to the DMV if you're applying for a state ID like me.
Even if it's an old family Bible with, you know, a birth record in it or a baptism record in a family Bible, bring whatever you have. They will take a look at it, try to figure out what they need to do to get you an ID so you can vote.
So let's say you don't have a birth certificate, you don't have a Social Security card. You can still get an ID through the ID petition process.
If you come in and fill out the regular ID application, which is the MV-3004, and then we have a separate petition application, mainly it's asking for birth certificate information because we will go ahead and do that research on your behalf if your birth certificate is unavailable. So we will work with you to track down the documentation that's needed to get some sort of electronic verification. You would not necessarily need to have your Social Security card, but we would need your number so that we can verify that electronically. Wisconsin residency. Most people have something on that, but if you don't, we will send you a letter. We just want to make sure that you can get government correspondence or you have some sort of utility bill in your name. And then, of course, with citizenship, usually that comes through with the birth certificate. So we do have a process that's available for people that do not have those documents available with them, but they need that free ID for voting. So we will work with people in that process. Even if it takes us a while to track down some of that information, we provide a receipt during that interim that is good for the purposes of voting as well. And especially at this point when we're so close to the election, we're sending those overnight mail so that people get them right away. So, yes, we're very cognizant to the timelines that we're under, and we want to make sure that people have what is needed in hand for when they vote.
When I started researching this process online, I found some conflicting information. Some websites pop up in a Google search that lay out a lot of prices for these IDs, but you can ignore that. If you're getting an ID for voting purposes, you don't need to pay anything. Because I had all of my information with me, I left with a receipt in hand, which I was able to use to vote at my local polling place. It should be noted you can use a variety of other IDs to vote. A driver's license, a passport, or a military ID all work. There are also other things, like university or college IDs, but they have to include specific information, like an expiration date, signature, and the date it was issued. There's a full list of acceptable photo IDs at myvote.wi.gov. If you're unsure whether or not your ID qualifies, you can still head to the polls and cast a vote.
Even if you were to go to vote, you realize you don't have identification that's valid for voting, you can go ahead and do a provisional ballot, then come into the DMV. We will collect your information. We'll overnight a receipt, and you can take that receipt back to City Hall to make sure that your vote is counted.
That was my experience getting a voter ID back in 2018, the same ID I continue to use today. At WUWM.com, you can find more of our election coverage and information on how to vote in this year's primary. Join us again on Monday when we'll explore what's on the partisan primary ballot in our Capitol Note series, plus get some tips on how to vote in Milwaukee. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. We're in the dog days of summer, which is good news if you're a fan of festivals and 5Ks. We'll learn about some of the many community events happening this month later in the show. But first, we'll look at a new Wisconsin Policy Forum report that compares Milwaukee with peer cities on the racial equity of home ownership in the city. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Research from the Wisconsin Policy Forum shows Milwaukee's large racial disparity in home ownership has widened over the last decade. The low and declining Black and Hispanic home ownership rates point to Milwaukee's acute racial equity challenges, and a new report from the forum adds to this research, confirming stark racial inequity in home ownership. The report, called Hitting Home, compares Milwaukee with 10 other peer cities in demographics and economics in the U.S. It looks at rates of owner occupancy, use of federal resources, and the strategies used to advance equity in home ownership. To put it bluntly, Milwaukee has the lowest home ownership rate among Black and Hispanic households combined. To learn more about the report's findings, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Ned Littlefield, the lead author and a research fellow at the Wisconsin Policy Forum.
Before we dive into the report's findings, what does the city's homeownership rates tell you? Why is this important?
A homeownership rate is important because it's an indicator of how collectively prosperous a city is. We all want our communities to be economically dynamic for all community members, right? So a key way to measure the extent to which a city is collectively prosperous is homeownership, because in the United States, homeownership is a main way that individuals and families or households develop intergenerational wealth. So a city's homeownership rate can reflect the extent of wealth in this city. The higher the home ownership rate, the wealthier a city is, generally speaking. But within a city, some racial groups may have different levels of home ownership than others. And the greater the difference between respective racial groups' home ownership rates, the less collectively prosperous we are, because the greater the racial inequities or the racial disparities in that access to intergenerational wealth building is. So in this case, homeownership rate specifically by race is an important indicator of the extent to which a community, or for our purposes, a city like Milwaukee, is advancing toward a racial equity and thus prosperity for everyone.
The Wisconsin Policy Forum released a research brief back in March that showed Milwaukee's large racial disparities in home ownership that it had widened over the last decade. So where does this new report that you worked on home ownership inequities offer more insight into that?
Yeah, thanks for being such a close reader, Audrey. So this report builds upon our March 2022 research brief in two main respects. The first is comparing Milwaukee with demographically and economically similar cities throughout the U.S. And the second is making this comparison not only regarding the state of racial equity in homeownership, but also regarding the use of federal funds to advance homeownership. So our research brief from March 2022 showed that Milwaukee has large and widening racial disparities, but that this is not specifically a Milwaukee problem relative to other Wisconsin cities like Madison, Green Bay, Kenosha, Racine, and relative to the state as a whole. In fact, Milwaukee is like comparably inequitable or somewhat less inequitable with respect to homeownership than these other geographies that we with which we compared the city. And we wanted to build upon that research by seeing to what extent that's the case when we bring in cities that have more in common with Milwaukee throughout the United States. So that's cities that are larger in terms of size, cities that are more diverse in terms of the combined number of Black and Hispanic residents, and cities that tend to have more in common in terms of the median household income and the median home value, as well as how affordable it is to own a home.
So which cities were the peer cities that Milwaukee compared to as closely?
Yeah, so we ended up selecting, based on those measures that I just mentioned, 10 cities throughout the United States. So these are Albuquerque, New Mexico, Baltimore, Maryland, Cleveland, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, El Paso, Texas, Fresno, California, Kansas City, Missouri, Memphis, Tennessee, Tampa, Florida, and Tucson, Arizona. So we selected them for similarities in terms of the measures that I mentioned, you know, population size, diversity, and how affordable it is to own a home. One way in which Milwaukee stood out is that it's the only city of these that where the Black and Hispanic populations combine to constitute over 50% of the city, but neither is predominant. So this suggests to us that Milwaukee has a unique balance of diversity here, in that we are a majority people of color city where neither group is as predominant as it is in other cities. And as a result, Milwaukee has a unique, we as a community have a unique responsibility to advance racial equity for all residents. And one way of doing so, of course, through homeownership in this case.
So given that Black and Hispanic residents make up more than half of Milwaukee's population, what does the report show and where we stand in the larger picture of equity and home ownership?
Yes, thank you. And this is another way that the report differs from the research brief that you mentioned earlier, in showing that, in fact, Milwaukee, when you compare Milwaukee with cities that have with which it has more in common, we actually have relatively acute disparities in home ownership. So some of the ways that it compares are that Milwaukee had the lowest combined Black and Hispanic homeownership rate in 2020 at 29%. And that's because Milwaukee had the lowest Black homeownership rate of these peer cities in 2020 at 25%, and the third lowest Hispanic homeownership rate among these peer cities in 2020 at 39%. So when you compare that to the white home ownership rate, which in Milwaukee is relatively low, you see that our city has the largest disparity between Black and Hispanic home ownership on the one hand and white home ownership on the other hand. That's a 27 percentage point disparity in 2020. So I've just described to you several respects in which the city of Milwaukee has, in 2020, which is the most recent date that we analyzed, has more acute racial disparities. These disparities, we also saw, deepened over the prior decade. So from 2010 to 2020, Milwaukee had the third largest decrease in the combined Black and Hispanic homeownership rate by 7 percentage points from 2010 to 2020. And over the same period, the past decade, Milwaukee had the largest increase in the disparity between Black and Hispanic homeownership on the one hand and white homeownership on the other hand, which was 5 percentage points. So when we look at both the historical perspective and the current perspective, we see that Milwaukee has comparatively severe disparities in terms of the percentage of Black and Hispanic households that own their own homes relative to other cities and relative to white households.
So given that there's a lot of factors that play into this, and sometimes people see homeownership as one side and some people see racial equity as a different thing, but when it comes to strategies you looked at, you mentioned federal funding as one of the things you observe, but how does Milwaukee's approaches to supporting homeownership and advancing racial equity in this area compare to the peer cities you reviewed? Are other cities doing a bit more work or have different strategies to make this better?
Yeah, so we aimed to answer that question in two ways. One was to examine how the cities used federal funding from the Department of Housing and Urban Development from 2010 to 2019 to advance homeownership. And the other was looking at the city's current strategies or their forward-looking approaches to advancing homeownership. So with respect to the use of federal funding, we found that Milwaukee stood out in the way that it has used federal funds to support a relatively large number of current homeowners with relatively small scale repairs, and at the same time supporting a relatively small number of potential homeowners with relatively large value investments in housing counseling, or in financing, or in building new home.
The comparison of investing in people who are already homeowners versus potential is one thing that stands out in the report for the city of Milwaukee, but what other key findings stand out the most to you?
So the fact that Milwaukee has more acute disparities than its peer cities is one key finding that stands out with me. And this is because it tells us that what we experience, what we see, what we live in Milwaukee with respect to racial inequity is not inevitable for a city of our size and diversity. There are other cities that have a similar profile in terms of the affordability of homeownership, size, demographics, that are less inequitable than Milwaukee is. So, in other words, it doesn't have to be this way. And the second key finding is the way that the city currently recognizes the importance of advancing racial equity in homeownership. And that is in several respects, but it's mainly in regard to the collective housing strategic plan that the city of Milwaukee participated in developing through the Community Development Alliance. The Community Development Alliance is a partnership between multiple housing stakeholders, governmental and non-governmental, in the city of Milwaukee. And it's unique in this respect because we could only find one other peer city that has this degree of collaboration in its strategic planning process for homeownership. And another way that this partnership is unique is that it represented one of the only peer city housing strategies that has both an explicit homeownership focus and an explicit racial equity focus. The Community Development Alliance specifically aims to create 32,000 additional homeownership opportunities for Black and Hispanic households over the next 30 years through a combination of supporting both current and prospective homeowners. So, in short, we have this acute challenge. We have previously made a decision to support current homeowners predominantly. And we as a city recognize that this is a challenge that we need to address in order to become more collectively prosperous, and that we need to do so in a way that supports both current and prospective homeowners.
Ned Littlefield is a research fellow at the Wisconsin Policy Forum and the main author of its report, Hitting Home: Milwaukee's Home Ownership Inequities and How We Compare to Peer Cities. According to the CDC, there was a significant rise in adults reporting anxiety and depression between April of 2020 and February of last year. Emergency room visits for drug overdoses at the same time increased by more than 30%. Many people are continuing to struggle with mental health and substance use disorders, especially as isolation persists and people feel uncertain about the future due to the COVID-19 pandemic. While some sparks of normalcy are beginning to return, these feelings aren't easy to overcome. To learn more about the resources available to people in the Milwaukee area, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Behavioral Health Division Administrator Mike Lappin.
So what have been some of those biggest persisting challenges to meet for the Behavioral Health Division, given this increased need and challenge?
Well, for us, we have very significant crisis services available, and we've spent the last several years attempting to provide a more upstream and proactive approach. So I think the biggest challenge is that folks are often unaware of the services that are available to them, and the fact that we will serve anybody, no matter how challenging their situation, without any sort of issue around their ability to pay. We will provide services to anybody who needs us. And I just don't think people are aware that help is just a phone call away through our crisis service.
So historically, how would people come to know or be involved in the services BHD does offer the city? And what do you want that forward shift to do?
Well, there's a couple of paths historically. One would be people often present at an emergency room. So they go to a general hospital emergency room, and while the staff there may have some experience, they're typically not set up to serve people in a mental health crisis. So they don't have a psychiatrist handy, or they don't have a social worker. And then the other way, unfortunately, in Wisconsin, is through law enforcement, because when in order to initiate care to someone in an emergency situation against their will, so someone who might be suicidal, maybe not quite ready for help, or someone who's really sick and kind of acts out, law enforcement has to be involved. And so for many, tragically, their first contact is with the law enforcement system or with an emergency room that really doesn't have the tools to help them. So what we've tried to do is prioritize a mobile community response that meets people where they're at, ideally one that gets to them before they feel the need to go to that emergency room or before they have that police contact. And then even in those cases, what we've done is we have a specialized emergency room in our psychiatric crisis service that anybody can come to and get an assessment in the moment by trained, experienced professionals, including 24/7 psychiatry. And we also have a team that is a co-responder team. It's called CART, or the Crisis Assessment Response Team. CART is a clinician who works for the Behavioral Health Services, paired with a Milwaukee police officer. And we also have a team in West Allis, and we have teams with the Milwaukee Sheriff's Office. And those officer and clinician teams respond to mental health emergencies. Data going back since we started the program basically says that 80% of the time when that team gets dispatched to a situation, the outcome is something other than an arrest or an emergency detention or an involuntary hold. And that's because those teams are so good at connecting people to the services they need and helping address the actual cause of that crisis in the moment. And they can, sometimes it's housing, sometimes it's they're hungry, sometimes it's there's a challenging situation with family, they need help and guidance, and sometimes they just need to get reconnected to a service provider who's already helped them, but for whatever reason, they've lost that connection, or just today, they don't have what they need, and they just need to get connected back to that important service.
So you touched upon it a little bit, and these services do go beyond a mental health crisis or substance abuse crisis, but focusing back on those two areas, what are some common signs of someone experiencing a crisis, whether someone's trying to notice this within themselves or say you're seeing a friend or a family member go through something that you think may need extra support?
Well, that's a great question. And I think a big part of getting the word out about the sort of epidemic of mental health and substance use challenges now is to help family members recognize in their loved ones what's going on, and also for people to recognize for themselves. And so when people often, if they're experiencing depression or anxiety, they might withdraw. They may lose interest in things that they previously were interested in or passionate about. They may, in some cases, in more challenging situations, start to become paranoid and believe people are out to get them, people are might harm them. They may avoid social situations. They may start missing work. They may start mentioning thoughts of harming themselves, thoughts of suicide. They might mention, oh, you know, perhaps I'd be better off dead. Those sorts of things are really significant signs. And we would strongly encourage that people just, and again, you just have to have a conversation. Hey, I'm really concerned. And you're not acting like yourself. Why don't you reach out, or let's make a connection so you can talk to someone who might help you find your way. There's so much stigma around mental health and substance use issues that people often don't want to reach out. When they finally get to that threshold, things are pretty serious, and they're struggling and they need that help. And it can really get to be a life or death situation. And we want to make sure that we are available and that there aren't barriers for people getting that care. Once they make that step to get help, we want to make sure that they get it right away.
So what's that good first step into getting help? What resources would you say is a great first point of access to start with?
So I believe that we operate a very effective crisis line in Milwaukee County. So the Behavioral Health Services crisis line is 414-257-7222. If you call that line, whether it's for yourself or for a family member, you will talk to someone who will ask some questions about what's going on and will be able to make connections to resources, not just mental health or substance use resources either, but would connect you to resources that would help. In the event that there's a significant crisis and that brief screening, there's some alarm bells that are rung here, and the screener would refer that call immediately to our crisis clinicians who will work 24/7 at our office. And that would trigger potentially a mobile crisis response. So we have a non-police mobile crisis system. It's therapists and nurses that get deployed throughout the Milwaukee community. And if there was a higher level of concern about someone's safety in the moment, and we didn't have a plan maybe for the next day, or we weren't comfortable with waiting, we would send the mobile team out. But that entire spectrum of service, whether it's a connection to an outpatient provider or maybe some assistance with housing, all could be accessed through that crisis line, and including an emergency visit from a mobile crisis team.
And this includes both adults and children, right?
Correct. We have teams. Historically, we've had separate teams for adults and kids. Recently, we've essentially combined the teams because of some staffing challenges, and also because of our philosophy. We've taken on a philosophy at the Department of Health and Human Services under the leadership of our director, Shakita LeGrant, that we are a no wrong door organization. So what that means is we want to make sure that we're treating the whole family, the whole spectrum of need that people might have. So when we send out a mobile team, it's often not just for a kid. Even if the call came in about a child, sometimes you go out and there's a challenge with the family. So by sort of blending our teams and sending out people with multiple skills and experience, we feel like we can do a more effective job in treating people in the moment and kind of meet the whole family where they're at when that's the appropriate intervention.
You mentioned staffing challenges, and of course, the pandemic has not only seen a rise in the need for services in regards to mental health assistance, substance abuse, things all along the spectrum, but also a need for more providers to meet this increased demand. So can you share with me what staffing currently looks like for you?
Staffing is a challenge. It's a challenge nationwide. I don't think there's a community-based provider, mental health provider, substance use provider that isn't really struggling right now. I have exciting news in that we have just been approved to expand our opportunities in that we will be able to offer some new and exciting shift pay, a differential pay for our second and third shift crisis mobile staff and our clinicians. And we also have approval and we're currently hiring. So anyone listening who would like to be part of a national best practice leader in behavioral health services in Milwaukee County, please reach out to our hiring site because we have a $7,500 signing bonus in place for crisis clinicians and pretty attractive hourly incentives and shift differentials and the like on nights and weekends. We need help. We're probably staffed at about 60%. We're not missing calls. We're not dropping the ball here because of staffing at this time, but our teams are really stressed. And like everyone, in the pandemic. These folks have not worked from home. They've not been remote. They've been out in the field throughout this thing, and we haven't missed a beat. And I'm so proud of my team. And I will shout out to them that our crisis mobile teams and our community health center partnership clinics, and really all of the folks that work with us and in partnership with us throughout our community. We have the largest network of community-based mental health providers in the state here in Milwaukee. People have just been amazing and have not missed a beat throughout the pandemic.
So ideally, what does the future of mental health resources look like for you in Milwaukee? Or what are we working towards?
We are working towards a system that is a no-wrong-door system with no barriers to people who need help. We want low-barrier access to mental health and substance use treatment. The way we're achieving that is through the mobile system that I've described. We did something like 5,000 crisis mobile visits last year between our adult, youth, and our police CART teams. But additionally, we've invested in partnerships with some federally qualified health centers in Milwaukee, where we actually have staff embedded at those clinics and work in partnership with them so that people can walk in and get immediate assistance if they're in a mental health crisis. And we can connect them to those mental health and substance use disorder treatment services that we have access to through our networks. But we also connect them to the federally qualified health centers, the fantastic work that those community resources do around physical health. Our goal is to have Milwaukee be the healthiest community in the state. And mental health and substance use are a big part of that. And helping people address their challenges and sort of destigmatizing those needs and making it just another part of your healthcare picture, you know, and just like you would go get help if you had diabetes or high blood pressure, we want people to see seeking mental health or substance use disorder services along those same lines. These are just health issues that professionals who are trained to help you are ready and willing to serve you. And the strong message here is, we'll help you no matter what your level of need is, no matter what your ability to pay is. You don't have to have insurance. We want to serve you. So whether you call our crisis line or you walk in at an access point, we want to be able to provide that service throughout the community and in a way that is culturally competent and effective. And we strongly embrace evidence-based practices. And we also work with, an amazing network, a very diverse network. And we do our best to get people services as close to where they live as possible, because we know that distance between providers or the length between appointments or any of those things can become a barrier to care. And by reducing those barriers, we believe we will achieve our audacious goal of being the healthiest community in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, Mike Lappin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on and helping us get the word out about what services are available.
Mike Lappin is an administrator for the Behavioral Health Division, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. You can reach the Behavioral Health Services Crisis Line by calling 414-257-7222. If you head to WUWM.com, you'll find additional resources for help with mental health and substance use disorders. Coming up, we'll look at some of the many events happening this month in Milwaukee, including a festival featuring local playwrights. We'll learn more next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. We're nearing the end of summer here in Milwaukee, and for many of us, that means taking every possible moment to enjoy the great weather. August is a perfect time to do that, with so many cultural festivals and events to get you outside in the fresh air. Every month, Sam Woods from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service shares with us some of the many events happening in the city. Sam, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Joy, it is a pleasure.
So we have a lot that is coming up in August. I think we sometimes refer to this as the dog days of summer, but here in Milwaukee, sure, there is a lot that we can still do out in the community. The first one is an annual tradition now in the city.
Yeah, it might be dog days, but also it's like the 2 months of the year that are nice to be outside, so... So the first one that we have is the Black Theater Festival, and this is theater as in kind of plays as opposed to like a film festival, which admittedly I thought it was at first. I was like, oh, another film festival. Excellent. But it's theater, it's plays. It happens between August 10th and August 14th at a variety of places in the city. Productions come from places like the Bronzeville Arts Ensemble, the Milwaukee Black Theater Company, the Milwaukee Chamber Theater, as well as individual local black playwrights. On topics such as gun violence, black women in NASA, and just overall black excellence and celebrating black culture.
Great way to check out some local theater companies and some local playwrights. Mm-hmm, I know there are a number of people who are involved in this.
Yeah.
The next festival that we're going to be looking at is, in fact, a film festival.
This we checked. It is, in fact, a film festival. It's a short one, though. It is it's 1 day. It spans about 90 minutes, and it's 16 short films having to do with the environment. And what's interesting about this film festival is that it's aimed at kids 12 and under to arrive with a parent or guardian to Havenwood State Forest. And if you've never been to Havenwood State Forest, I would recommend, while it's nice out in the dog days of August, to visit. It's a beautiful park on the far north side. I mean, it's a state forest within city boundaries, which is, you know, not necessarily what you'd expect, and it's a treasure, if I can say so. But this film festival, the Wild Child Film Festival at Haven Woods, again, bring your children. 16 short films spanning 90 minutes, touching on environmental issues. Should be an interesting night. Should be a fun night.
And you can check out it. It's in fact the only urban state forest.
Really, in the entire country?
No. In Wisconsin.
Womp, womp. All right. But still impressive.
Very impressive.
Yes. And it's worth a visit.
So the next thing we're looking at is actually also in a park, not a state park, but a very popular local park. And you'll get to learn all about it.
Yes. Shirley, you've heard about Washington Park, but on August 7th, you can take a walking tour with a landscape historian and journalist, Virginia Small. She'll tell you all about Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed the park way back in the 1800s, and he actually designed parks all over the United States, including Central Park in New York. But you'll learn about him and kind of his vision for the park, how it used to be a zoo, believe it or not. It used to be an entire zoo in there. But you also learn about the freeway's impact on its access and experience, and as well as like kind of looking to the future, prospects for the future. So you may know Washington Park, you may have been to Washington Park, but here you can really get to know the history of everything that has happened in Washington Park, everything Washington Park has been.
For sure. Now, if you are hoping to take that walk a little bit faster,
yes,
there
yes.
are a couple of 5Ks that are happening mm-hmm. in the city this month.
Yeah, so first one I'll shout out is the Harambe 5K. So this happens on August 5th, and this is the 7th annual Harambe, which is in some ways, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a 5K, right? If you're familiar with 5Ks, it's like that. But the backstory is also interesting. It's run by Tonda Thompson, who grew up in Harambe and now owns several businesses, including She Slangs Wood, which is a lumber and woodworking business with a mission to teach black women carpentry. And she brings in interns from MPS schools. And it's just if you haven't heard of Tonda or She Slangs Wood or the Valor Collective, worth a Google. Definitely learn more about her. But this 5K was originally designed to raise awareness and to prevent unhealthy birth outcomes across the nation. It's organized by Tonda and the National Coalition for Healthy Black Families. And the mission is to promote wellness by encouraging families to stay healthy and fit, both mentally and physically. So this is another one you can bring your kids to. You can even bring strollers to. You might not imagine that as a 5K, like, oh, I would you know, run with my child, but that is encouraged at this 5K. But if you miss that, the next week on August 13th, there's also another 5K on the Hank Aaron State Trail. This one is another annual event. It's a good way to meet your neighbors and get fit. And, you know, you could even do both, right? They're on different days, different weekends. Point is that it's a good opportunity to get out and meet your neighbors.
Great way to see different parts of the city as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, there are a lot of different festivals that are happening in August that pull from a variety of different communities.
Yeah, so it is that time of year again. August means, and summer really, but August especially kind of at least makes me think of all the cultural festivals that are happening throughout the city, really, but also a lot of them happening on Summerfest grounds. First one I want to shout out on August 5th is Black Arts Fest. It's on again on the Summerfest grounds, and it's an opportunity to celebrate Black music and art. But there's also a couple days later, on August 7th, in Jackson Park on the kind of southwest side of the city, there's a Puerto Rican festival, which is a chance to kind of learn more about and immerse into Puerto Rican culture, music, food, dance, community fun, all that good stuff. And then, of course, at the end of the month, August 26th through 28th, Mexican Fiesta, back on the Summerfest grounds. It's worth a stroll, eat some food, listen to some music, dance, be in community, have fun. It's a great time.
Do all the fun stuff that August has to offer.
Yes, yes. And it has a lot to offer beyond just this. Yeah, get outside.
Sam, as always, thank you for joining us on Lake Effect.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
Sam Woods is a staff reporter at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he regularly joins us to talk about some of the events happening in the city. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about a local effort to teach people about Sikhism as we near the 10th anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting. And we'll look at some of the pitfalls of automated hiring systems that have become the norm for many U.S. companies. All of that is tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.